Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's breathcast is with Chris Lemons, who is the star of the Netflix documentary Last Breath. If you haven't seen that documentary yet, I encourage you, as soon as you finish watching this podcast, to go and find that documentary and have a watch. I watched it last week just as I wasn't feeling very well and was looking for something to watch on Netflix to pass some time, and very, very powerful, emotional documentary. And without giving too much away, Chris is a North Sea commercial diver, and he gets stranded at the bottom of the North Sea and goes without oxygen for up to 40 minutes and survives to tell the tale without brain damage. So it's an incredible story. It's an incredible documentary, and Chris is a really, really great guy. I loved speaking to him. Such a lovely person with such a powerful tale to tell. So we get into it all, you know, meaning of life, what happened, how it happened, thoughts looking back after making a documentary about yourself. Spoiler, when you're watching the documentary, obviously you know now he's alive because I'm talking to you. But when I watch the documentary, they don't reveal that till about the last 15 minutes. So I'm watching this documentary thinking this poor guy died on the bottom of the North Sea floor all by himself. And then there's a bit of a reveal at the end. Oh, cheeky. But makes the film even more powerful. So I hope you enjoy this breathcast. Just a couple of quick messages before we do get stuck into it. Can you please, if you haven't done so already, like, subscribe and share. It helps grow our breathwork community. Talking of breathwork, so this is our breathcast, our podcast. We do also have over 100 videos dedicated to different breathing exercises. And we also have this breathcast. So we've been interviewing some of the world's top breathing experts, wellness experts, and there's a really decent back catalogue of conversations there. So if you're listening to this, you can find it on iTunes, you can find it, you know, on Spotify, but also you can watch all of these conversations and practice all these breath works on YouTube as well. So that'd be wonderful if you get some time to have a look at that. And then the last message really is, if you haven't done so already, pop on over to Instagram, takeadeepbreath.co.uk, and give us a follow on there. That would be wonderful. Anyway, enough yakking from me. Let's go meet Chris and let's get stuck into the breathcast. Cheers. Okay, and we are recording. So, Chris, thank you so much, mate, for coming on to the Take a Deep Breath podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I'm going to apologise on my behalf for the poor quality and the boxes behind me. As I explained, we're moving house, so it's not great for TV, but there we go.
No worries at all. It's so wonderful to have you on. And just for the viewers, so I've had, not COVID, but I just had awful flu for about 2 weeks. And the other day I was just surfing through Netflix, trying to find something to watch. And those that know me will know that I obviously take a deep breath work. And I just saw a title called Last Breath. And I thought, hang on, I've not seen this before. What's going on here? How's this snuck behind me? And I was just, Chris, I was mesmerized. From the minute I put it on, I laughed, I cried. And I've told so many people, you need to go and watch this documentary. So I thought, let's unpack that a little bit. So first of all, can you just tell people what you do for a living?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm what's called a commercial diver, but I'm in particular, I'm a, what's called a saturation diver, which is a profession people don't really know too much about, I suppose. The film you're talking about, I always wondered how they were going to fill an hour and a half with what happened. But I think sort of the reason it works is it explains this world of saturation diving that people aren't aware of, really. And I certainly wasn't aware of it until I started doing it. But yeah, basically I'm a commercial diver, which means I dive for money, really. And I work almost exclusively out in the oil and gas industry. So that's sort of working on this, you know, principally on the, I work in the North Sea mostly, but, you know, in my time I've worked all around the world, really. But that just involves installing, maintaining, inspecting basically the infrastructure, which is sort of the oil and gas infrastructure, which brings the, you know, oil and gas back to the mainland. You know, most of that is on the seabed of the world's, yeah, shallower seas and oceans, I guess. Yeah. So that's it.
Well, and how did you get involved in making that your job? What led you to that?
Yeah, I wish I had a more romantic story about this, really. The other two guys in the film, Dave and Duncan, they both sort of came to dive in through a passion for it, really. They were, Duncan sort of is a bit older than me, grew up watching Jacques Cousteau and all that kind of thing. And Dave was a scuba diving instructor out in Thailand, and they both sort of found a way to make their their passion, their profession. And that wasn't really the case for me. It was just something I fell into. I was sort of quite young, maybe about 20, I think, and a point in my life where I didn't really know what to do in terms of a career and things like that. And a friend's father just found me a stopgap job, really, a summer job almost on the back deck of one of these, what's called a dive support vessel, a DSV. And it sort of all went from there, really. I got to see or witness firsthand these divers working, and I'm sure we'll come onto it a little bit, but these guys live in decompression chambers for nearly a month at a time. So you don't really get to see them face to face, but you get to watch them on screens, and they seem like a sort of mysterious and interesting group, I suppose, who did this fascinating job. You know, I've since learned very different, obviously, but at the time it seemed slightly romantic, and I think I knew pretty much there and then that that's what I wanted to pursue. And so I worked a few years on the deck, and then I went off to be what's called an air diver, which is exactly what it says in the tin, which means breathing air, which limits you to 50 meters of depth commercially. I sort of did that all over the world, and then you progress to doing saturation diving, which you have to do more courses and things like that. And that's what I've been doing ever since for about the last 11 or 12 years. Yeah.
And do you actually do diving for fun as well? Do you like scuba diving and, you know, snorkeling on your holidays, or you think, do you know what, that's work, I don't want to be in the water right now?
Very little, actually. But, you know, the weird thing is I don't have a PADI qualification. So when you go on holidays, so I've got a professional diver's certificate and all that kind of thing. But when you go on holiday, you normally need a PADI thing to rent bottles. So I never really do it. Yeah. I occasionally go from home and pick up scallops and stuff like that. We've got a rib here. And but very little, to be honest. But it's not because I don't want to particularly. It's funny because I work in a place that's, you know, pitch black and very, very deep. And actually, when it comes to sort of social diving, I'm a bit more timid. You know, I'm quite happy just going, you know, very, very shallow and looking at a couple of fish, really. I don't really have ambitions beyond that.
Just curious to know, yeah, because I've never done any actual diving with air or anything like that. I've only done the snorkeling, and I actually really loved that, but I've never been brave enough, I think, because there is something, definitely, and obviously we'll talk about you in a second in this, but there's something about running out of oxygen that just, or the oxygen doesn't work properly. But I know it's a very safe industry, and a lot of people.
But I mean, it's a perfectly natural thing to worry about. I think if you didn't worry about that, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I completely understand. And so we'll come on to it. But yeah, as you say, for me, in some ways, scuba diving, you know, on your own, going to look at the fish with a bottle on your back is more dangerous than what we do, strangely, because it is so controlled and so regulated. And, you know, on my boat, for example, we have, you know, over 100 people on the boat specifically to put two men on the seabed. So that's, you know, a massive support network, if you like. So a lot of the dangers involved with diving, of decompression and of running out of gas, are hopefully eliminated. Yeah, but yeah, as you come on to, not always. Yeah.
Yeah. No, let's get on to that then. So I know this is going to be hard, because this is obviously the whole purpose of the documentary, but I'd like you to kind of explain what happened to you on that day, if you can. And before you do, I'll just say, I didn't know what happened to you when I watched it, and I'm so glad, because obviously anybody watching this now, spoiler alert, you're here talking to me, so you're alive. But I didn't know that, and I'm thinking, oh my god, I'm surprised they're being so candid about everything that happened, and somebody passed away doing this. And it was only when that reveal happened, I was like, oh, you sneaky swines, because I had no idea. And I was obviously really relieved and very emotional at that point. But it was a very well done documentary. So Chris, can you tell us what kind of the purpose, what is the reason of that documentary, what happened?
In terms of what happened, it's basically an incident which happened to myself and my colleagues back in 2012, so it's, you know, just over 8 years ago now. And yeah, to put it quickly, it's quite difficult, but yeah, essentially the boat we work on operates with what's called a dynamic positioning system, which is a series of thrusters which holds the boat in one position above the seabed. So we don't drop anchors or anything like that. We just rely on all these computers and these thrusters to hold the boat in one place to allow us to work on the seabed. And we need the boat to stay in one place because we are attached to it by umbilical. So we go down each day in a diving bell. On the day in question, we were diving at about 91 meters, I think. So the bell would probably be lowered to about 81 meters on a wire. And there's a main umbilical which goes down to the diving bell and supplies the bell And in turn, three umbilicals, one for each of the divers, with breathing gas, with hot water, because it's very cold down there. So we get a hot water supply, which is pumped around our suits to keep us warm, power, electricity to power a torch and a camera on our heads. The gas we breathe is actually helium and oxygen mix. So that's very expensive. So that's sucked back to the surface. There's another hose for that so they can recycle it and save a bit of money. So it is literally what it sounds like. It is an umbilical. It is a lifeline, literally. For that reason, and also for operational reasons in terms of using cranes and things like that, the boat needs to stay in one place at all times. So what happened essentially on that day is we had a catastrophic single point failure of that system, of the dynamic positioning system. It was about 10 o'clock at night. It was fairly rough. It was about 35 knot winds, I think, and about a 6 meter swell. So fairly typical for the North Sea, to be honest, but nevertheless, you know, it's not really flat calm, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And in those circumstances, in the pitch black, the bridge suffered this catastrophic failure. All their screens went black and they basically lost control of the boat and it started to drift away uncontrolled, like a sailboat, really. So at the moment that happened, there were three of us in the water. We work in teams of three. One of the team of three always stays in the diving bell every day. It's a position we rotate every day. But on that particular day, it was a guy called Duncan Alcock, who was in the bell. And then in the water were myself and my friend Dave Uassa. So we were working within a structure, sort of a manifold, which is on the seabed, about the size of a house. To give you a bit of context, and we were sort of deep within that when we heard these alarms going off in our helmets. We have a constant line of communication up to a dive controller who tells us everything that's going on and feeds us our instructions all day long, really. It is just paint by numbers, really. We do as we're told. But in the background we could hear these alarms, and it was a strange one because we hear alarms quite a lot because often they're testing and things like that, but there was something about the tone of his voice and so on which told us that this wasn't a drill or anything like that, but there was something more serious happening, although we didn't really understand what. And to cut a long story short, really, we sort of made our way out of the structure, and whilst we were trying to get back to the diving bell, which was obviously moving away from us in a direction and a place, you know, we didn't know. It's pretty much pitch black dark down there. My umbilical, which comes from the diving bell, is attached to my waist and then feeds my diving helmet. We wear a sort of 20 kg diving helmet. That became snagged on something at such incredible speed that I was powerless to do anything about it, really. And I effectively at that point became an anchor for a 5,000 ton vessel, really. And there's obviously only ever going to be one winner in that. And eventually the umbilical itself stretched to the point of breaking and snapped, and I was left behind. And we talked briefly there about running out of gas. You know, that's something we never worry about when we're diving, because we have this essentially infinite supply which comes down through our umbilicals with multiple backups in the event of any kind of failure. But to have your umbilical severed is pretty much unprecedented, and that left me just with the emergency supply which we carry on our back. When I lost my sort of standard supply, we have a knob on our helmet which we turn, which opened this emergency supply. And at that depth, about 91 meters, I think we calculated, I think the film makes it out to be about 5 minutes, but the truth is it's probably more like 7 or 8 is probably the real truth. But depending on how quickly I breathed it down, which I'm sure you're going to want to talk about a bit. 7 or 8 minutes. And the boat was completely out of control. They were unable to get back to help me. I sort of hung around on the seabed really for those 6, 7, 8 minutes, realizing fairly quickly that they weren't going to be able to get to me. That my chances, it dawned on me fairly quickly that my chances of rescue were pretty much non-existent when I realized the bell was no longer there. And eventually passed into unconsciousness. And it was nearly 40 minutes later, but the boat was able to regain control, and they were able to bring it back to me and come down and drag me back to the bell. And and they pulled me in, gave me a couple of breaths, and I came around, which sounds miraculous, you know. And I think the reason the film was made really was because all of this is on film. We have cameras on our hats, and there's also a remotely operated vehicle in the water with us which was able to film all of this and got back to me long before the boat was able to. So there's quite a bit of harrowing footage in the film of me, yeah, sort of twitching and writhing, and then eventually stopping twitching and writhing on the bottom. And you know, to all intents and purposes, my colleagues all assumed, you know, for good reason, that I was dead. And yeah, so that's it, really. Yeah, that was the basis of the film.
what a story! And by the way, you just did a great job of explaining it all. But at the same time, when you watch the hour and a half documentary and you see it step by step, and you don't know if you're alive or not until that point where the guy gives you CPR, and then obviously you are alive. Unbelievable. That's why I'm so excited to talk to you today, and just fair play to you. What an experience, what a story that's going to, you know, that you're going to tell, and people are going to obviously want to hear for years and years to come, Chris. So fair play. And I think my first, I guess what, there's loads of stuff I've been wanting to ask you around this. I guess the first bit, so that's interesting. So the hot water's been pumped around your suit then to keep you warm. That's what's going on there, is it? How quickly after the snap did you start to get cold? Did you start to feel that? Was it almost instantly, or was it took a bit of time?
Well, the cold's a very strange thing, yeah. So, yeah, we're fed this hot water. We it's very little technology involved with our wetsuits. They're actually pretty loose-fitting, old, raggedy things with a network of pipes which run around them, a bit like a sort of garden irrigation system, if you like. It's probably the best way to describe it. You know, hoses with little holes in. And your suit is just flooded with hot water. And it's very nice. It's like diving in a jacuzzi. Once you've dived that way, you don't ever want to do it any other way. Being too hot is normally the problem. And getting too hot, we regulate by, we have a valve on our hip, which we can twist to sort of dump some of that hot water, because that's often the problem. But if you turn the valve the whole way, or it gets knocked, or one of your mates thinks it's funny to turn it off, if, you know, when you're not looking, you get cold extremely, extremely quickly. You know, 30 seconds, you are hypothermic. It's nearly 4 degrees down there at that time of year. So, it's, you know, extremely cold. So yeah, when it comes to the cold, I'd love to answer your question, but the truth is I can't, strangely, because I always feel like I have this very lucid memory of everything that happened that night, you know, that I can recount it. I'm sure some of it's become a bit of a Shaggy Dog story, you know, grown arms and legs, but you know, at its core, I think I recount what happened and I can remember what happened, but I don't have any recollection at all of being cold, none, you know. Which is very strange. And it either suggests, I was chatting to someone the other day, actually, sort of diving expert, and he was saying, you know, it's possibly just that your body, just, you know, when it goes into pure survival mode, finds a way to switch off the things you don't really need to know about. I don't know, your brain doesn't. It's either that, or my recollection is not as lucid as I remember, you know, and that I'm you know, maybe imagining some of it. So it's hard to know, really. But yeah, I don't have any recollection of being cold, but I would have been. I mean, when I got back to the bell, and they took my helmet off. I can't remember if that's actually described in the film, but Duncan said, oh, my head was literally bright, bright blue. And, you know, he said he'd seen lips with cyanosis before, but in my whole head was a very, very, very bright blue. And it takes quite a while once they sort of managed to get me back in the bell, and then the bell has to be withdrawn back up to the boat and locked onto the chamber system that we live in, because you have to remain at pressure all the time. That's a process which takes about 35 minutes or something like that. And I think I was still at about 35 and a half degrees when they measured my temperature nearly 45 minutes later. So I was still hypothermic there, and they had been warming me gently with hot water for some time. So obviously, yeah, extremely cold, which I'm sure played a significant part in my survive as well, of course. But yeah, weirdly, I don't have any particular memory of it.
No, that's interesting, isn't it, how the body goes into that survival mode. When you were getting warm back up again, did you get extreme shivers, or do you not really remember that piece either?
I don't remember that, but they were very gentle. Most of the guys in there, they sort of do fairly advanced medics courses, so they know, you know, they know that not to just douse you with boiling hot water. Very gentle process. So I know when I got back to the system and I was lying in, you know, they literally stripped me naked on camera. I didn't put that in the film, thank goodness. No one wants to see that. But yeah, I suffered. The only thing I really suffered was shock, you know, so I vomited a bit, and I'm sure I was shivering a bit at that point. But I think whether that was cold or whether that was, you know, the natural symptoms of shock, you know, very sleepy and things like that. So,
Wow. So when the umbilical snapped, does it automatically kick into the reserve oxygen, or did you have to manually do something?
No, you manually, yeah. So it's online, so the pressure's always there, but you just have a little valve on the on your right temple, basically on the outside of the helmet, and you turn. But that's a very instinctive thing. It's something we practice. Certainly when you're training as a diver, that's something, that's pretty much all you do, really, is practice running out of gas, you know.
Oh, okay. So it's something you train for.
I don't know why, but yeah, that day it proved useful. Yeah, you don't really, you don't really have to think too much about that. Yeah, that was a instinctive thing.
And is it pure O2 that you've got in there, or is it a mix of air? What do you know what the percentages were of what they had in the reserve tanks?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Pure O2 would kill you at that depth, yeah, under that kind of pressure. Right. Actually, we breathe, so because of the partial pressures of oxygen, if you were to breathe air at 91 metres for any length of time, you would suffer both serious nitrogen narcosis, so sort of like a very drunk feeling, you know, which is debilitating. You wouldn't, your decision making just goes out the window, and it's like being full of whiskey, really. But also, you can suffer over a prolonged period. You can suffer oxygen toxicity, which is puts you into convulsions and things like that. So I can't remember exactly what we're breathing that day, but yeah, often we can breathe as little as 2% oxygen on the seabed.
Right.
So
okay.
We breathe something called heliox, which is a helium and oxygen mix, as it sounds like. So they basically exchange the nitrogen in air, you know, normally 79%, obviously they exchange that for helium, another inert gas, but which has none of the narcotic effect that the nitrogen has under pressure. And then they reduce the content of oxygen based on whatever depth we're going to be working at. So if we're working, you know, 150 meters, we can be breathing, as I said, as little as 2% oxygen, and you wouldn't know that on the bottom. You breathe out on the surface, you'd fall unconscious straight away, but on the bottom you don't. So we always work in partial pressures, so you know, you breathe an increasing amount of oxygen based on where you are. So when we're living in the chambers on the boat, I think it's about 0.4, I better not say this on live because I'll get it wrong, but about 0.4 you know, millibars of oxygen, and that goes up through to being in the bell, you breathe a bit more. While you're working on the seabed, you're breathing a bit more, and then actually in your tank, I think it's 1.6 millibars. So I think it was about, I can't think what it was now. I think it was about 16% O2 that day, I think, something like that. You know, less than you would breathe on a surface. But yeah, that concentration option is slightly higher. So in those last couple of minutes, or, you know, last 6 or 7 minutes of gas I was breathing, that was if I was breathing out on the surface, it would be a very high concentration of oxygen.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And were you letting a little bit in at a time, or did you just switch on and you just breathing it as it's coming out?
Yeah, you just switch it on. Yeah, switch it on and breathe normally, completely. Okay. Yeah.
So you're not trying to conserve it and think, right, a little bit, wait a little bit, put a little bit in. You just let it flow.
No, I mean, literally, you wouldn't be able to breathe if it wasn't in there. Yeah, right. Yeah, it'd be gone straight away. You'd be sucking on nothing. Yeah, which is an unpleasant sensation. But I mean, there was definitely a case of, I mean, when I first turned it on, I was still in the midst of a serious panic. Really, I actually lost my supply of gas before the umbilical snapped. You know, a few seconds before, really. That's all. But I don't know as much of been stretched to such an extent that the gas couldn't pass down it. You know, and at that point I'm thrashing around like a wild fish trying to free myself, and, you know, desperately frightened, obviously. And then the umbilical snaps and I fell about 10 or 11 meters down from the top of the manifold, which is where I was when that happened, back to the seabed in the darkness, trying to find my way back to the diving bell. So there was, you know, I don't know what it was, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 minutes where I'm in panic mode, really, and trying, and, you know, the thoughts of controlling your breathing or anything like that were not, they just weren't there, to be honest. Once I got to the top, I found a way to climb up to the top of this manifold, you know, fully expecting to see the diving bell above me somewhere lit up as my savior, if you like. And when I got to the top and it wasn't there, and I realized that, you know, even if it had been there and Dave was on his way down to get me, my chances were going to be slim because of the amount of time it had taken. But to see nobody there at all and no sign of anybody, I realized very quickly that, you know, I wasn't going to get out of this. And that had a strangely calming effect on me. I think because I wouldn't say I'd given up hope, because I was definitely hoping, but, you know, I was, you know, I think coherent enough to realize that, you know, my chances were very, very slim. And that had, as I said, that had a calming effect. And I do remember slightly thinking, you know, I must control my breathing rate. And I sort of almost put myself in the fetal position on the bottom and try to slow my breathing and control it. But in a weird way, it was almost a natural thing that happened, because the panic just subsided and faded out of me completely, I think, because there was nothing worth panicking over. It was over, really. And it was just, I was sort of overcome by grief and sadness and thoughts of home and all the, you know, that the horrible things you can imagine you start thinking when you know you certainly think, you know, you've got just a, you know, 3 or 4 minutes left to live, really, and you're going to die in this horrible place. So, it's a strange one, because we'll never know So the remotely operated vehicle got to me eventually, but it was able to get to, the boat was nearly 250 meters away, out of control. They were fighting to find a way to regain control of it. Dave, my fellow diver, has an umbilical which is only 50 meters long, so he wasn't able to get to me because he was already, you know, he was 200 meters away, if you like. But the remotely operated vehicle had a tether of something like 300 meters, so eventually that was able to swim over and film me, basically, which you see in the film. But by the time it gets to me, I'm already unconscious, so we'll never know how long that tank, which, you know, we can do the maths and it's based on an average breathing rate under 40 liters a minute or something like that under pressure, you know, under emergency conditions, you know, so we work out about 7 or 8 minutes. How long it actually lasted, I don't know. You know, it's felt to me like it lasted a long time, but your sense of memory in that situation, I suspect, is suspect at the very least. Yeah,
bloody hell. And when that little submarine comes down, the little remote submarine, and it, up until that point, have you been in complete pitch blackness?
Yeah, it was... yeah, I mean, it's always dark down there anyway, and the visibility is often quite poor because you kick up mud and things like that. So we're used to that kind of thing. But yeah, when I lost my umbilical, it was, yeah, absolutely the most, you know, if you imagine get up in the middle of the night, you know, with all the lights off and trying to find your way to the toilet when you're blind, you know, literally you can't see a speck of light. It was very, very much like that. So absolutely nothing, yeah. So yeah, the first light would have been when that came back, but I don't even, you know, I was unconscious at that point.
Yeah.
Slightly misleading in the film because I'm sort of moving, but I think that's...
It looks like you're waving a bit. I thought you were waving at them, but you're kind of just twitching.
Yeah, just twitching, I think. Yeah, twitching and, yeah, goodness knows what. And a bit, there was quite a bit of tide, so I think I'm blowing around in the wind a little bit, as we say. But, yeah, so... Yeah, it would have been nice to see a light, but I don't ever remember seeing it. That's
Wow. Okay, that adds a bit more to the story now, because I just assumed that you'd saw that coming and then you'd passed out. But okay, no, that's interesting. Yeah. Wow. So, because there's a bit in that film where you're trying to decide which way to get back to the structure, and you have to make a decision: is it left, is it right? And you find, don't you, which is the right way back to the structure? But
That's very convincing, just because it's very, very good acting, that bit. Yeah, it's about the only bit in the film I did. I'm sort of like this, and he takes the mickey out of me. It's terrible. I'm the only person in history who's played themselves and done it badly. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted. Sorry, you were asking a question. Sorry.
No, that's funny. So, but there really was a decision there, wasn't there? And obviously, there's a series of like good luck and bad luck going on through this whole thing. But there was a point there. Had you just gone like, you know, I don't know, the other way, that would have been it for you, surely, because they wouldn't have found you, would they, if you'd not been on top of that structure? Or it would have been harder to find you, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's a good point, yeah. Exactly as you say, we had this massive dose of bad luck, basically, followed by a whole series of doses of incredibly good luck, really, which contributed, you know, ultimately to my survival. But yeah, that was definitely one of them. When it wasn't really a decision, it was just a complete pot luck. I got up and... Down there, it's, you know, sometimes it's, when it's really bad, it's hard to tell which way's up and down almost, you know. And, you know, the best of us, of which I'm not one of them, but yeah, all of us get lost down there very, very easily. And it's very easy to make a fool of yourself with a light and a camera, a compass, and somebody telling you exactly where to go, you know, left a bit, right a bit. So, yeah, it's completely disorientating. So yeah. I was very lucky. I just put my arms out in front of me and hoped that I would take a couple of paces and hit the structure, which I did. But as you said, I could easily have turned and gone in the other direction and ended up in no man's land, which would have, I think they would have found me eventually. I had a beacon on me, you know, so they were able they had a radar guy who was able to bring them, you know, bring it back to me, but they were really struggling with that. The accuracy of that would not have, maybe not have been sufficient. Normally it's up on a nice screen for them to see, but just given a range and bearing would have been very, very hard. It would also have meant, I mean, it's maybe won't bore you with it too much, but we have a cardinal rule on the boat that you never drop the diving bell below the height of any structure on the seabed, because basically it will become an anchor and you start endangering the entire vessel. So, you know, had I been on the seabed, that would have been far, far, far more difficult for them to come and rescue me. And it would have been more time. And, you know, when I talked to any expert about, you know, I went down and sort of spoke to them at the Royal Medical Society in London and stuff about that, and they don't really have any particular answers, but one thing they're fairly sure of is that the margin between not just necessarily living and dying, but living and having, you know, terminal, you know, serious brain damage must have been infinitesimal, you know, extremely small.
Yes.
So any sort of help I was able to give them, which wasn't a conscious thing, it was just a, you know, you're going to try and do your best to get back to the diving bell in that situation, whatever. So it's nothing good on my part. But yeah, it was definitely a big dose of luck, as you say.
Yeah. So from the moment the cord snapped till you got that first breath of resuscitation, what was that time frame?
I think it's about 39 minutes or something like that. I think, yeah, 39, 40 wow. minutes. Yeah, so crazy, really. It is crazy. Crazy. To think. And, as I said, we don't know exactly how long I had something to breathe, but, you know, we're going to guess, let's say, by some miracle, I managed to hang on to it for 10 minutes, you know, as opposed to 7 or 8. You know, that's still 30 minutes, isn't it, with zero to breathe. And it's difficult to fathom. And I often, you know, I often cite as a sort of inferred there, really, but the miracle for me is not so much the survival, which does seem miraculous in itself, but it's survival without any, well, at least no one's been brave to tell me, you know, brave enough to tell me otherwise, any sign of any kind of brain damage yet.
Yeah,
you know, oxygen deprivation,
yeah,
first thing to go is your brain very, very quickly, as, you know, I'm sure you know. So amazing.
Wow. So yeah, we you can say comfortably half an hour with no breathing really going on, because the oxygen's gone 5 to 7 minutes, maybe 9 minutes. There's still another 30 minutes there before somebody gives you resuscitation breath. Yeah. And in those 30 minutes, and for that, I guess you're not conscious for that 30 minutes, as far as you're aware. You were not awake.
No, definitely not. I mean, they're sitting in the, as you say, the film, there's, you know, there's a couple of extracts of that footage of the ROV. You know, you see me twitching a bit, but, you know, the real version lasts, you know, well over 30 minutes, which probably would give us an idea, actually, how long it is. Yeah. And it's harrowing to watch. And I twitch a bit at the start, like you say, but that twitch stops. And then, you know, I am motionless and there's no, you know, certainly no sign of life. It looks like there's a water line within my helmet, you know, maybe just below the nose, another massive dose of good fortune that didn't drown, you know? So yeah, we'll never really know, but, it does still beg a belief to this day, really.
Yeah, bloody hell. And in the suit itself, if there's no oxygen, if the whole thing's switched off and you're just in that suit, how long would you be able to breathe in that suit for, do you reckon? Is it just seconds or a couple of minutes? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, so it's just a hat, really. So the suit's open to the elements. Yeah, so you wear what's called a neck dam. So it's like a rubber latex seal around your neck with a metal ring, and that fixes onto this helmet. So you've only really got the volume of gas that's in your hat. Normally, if, you know, let's say the bellman decided, you know, to be funny and switch your gas off, you'd still have the gas that remains in the umbilical. So that, you know, that probably, I don't know what that last 30 seconds, depending on your depth, you know. But yeah, if it was just the gas in your hat under normal circumstances, no, it's just, you know, I don't know, two, three, four breaths.
It's like having a bag over your head almost, isn't it? Yeah.
Not far off. If there's a little cavity there, it's sort of open a little bit. Yeah. But yeah, not much, that's for sure.
Wow.
You know, that sort of volume of gas, and, you know, was possibly, and as you touched on there, the quantity of oxygen within that gas must almost certainly have contributed to my salvation. Yeah.
Again, it's still really, I feel quite emotional even talking to you, because for most of that film, I thought you died. So I guess there's a bit here, and I don't know if I'll get emotional saying it, but there's a bit where you have been rescued and you're talking, I think, to the doctor, and you put your hand on his leg, and what do you say to him?
Yeah, so that's Stu. So we're Stu's a diver medic. So we're all trained diver medics. Yeah, he's not really, to call him a doctor, I think, you know, he's a very clever man, but I wouldn't say he's a doctor. but yeah, he we had so I'll tell you what I suck. What did I say? You have to tell me. I can't remember. I think he said I said something about, you know, dying's not that bad, and you know, I think I tried to reassure him from memory. And you're right, it's a really emotional bit of the film, isn't it? Because particularly because Stu's from Inverness, and, you know, he's a pretty tough guy and generally not the kind of bloke you'd expect to see crying, I suppose, is a bit of a cliche, I know, but just goes to show, doesn't it? Now, we probably letting the cat out of the bag here, but there a lot of the film is genuine footage, you know, it really is. You know, all the stuff underwater, most of the accident, that is. But we don't record anything in the chamber, for example. So there are a few bits of the film we recreated, and that was one of them. So that scene we recreated for the film. But when we were doing that, the guy said to me, "Oh, we're gonna recreate this bit in the chamber," and they sort of told me what they wanted to do and what I was supposed to pretend to do, grab his hand and stuff like that. And I just laughed because I absolutely no memory of that whatsoever.
Right.
Again, which tells you a little bit, you know, about maybe how good my recollection is. Yeah. I don't remember that at all. Yeah, and I felt bad about that because I laughed. I was with Stu at the time, obviously, because we recreated it together, and I was, you know, laughing and joking about it. And then I watched the film back, and I saw his interview, which I hadn't seen before. And you know, you realize what an effect it had had on him, and how emotional he gets. And that's that's amazing. It's powerful stuff, really. And that's something we found a lot since, you know, since the accident happened. But the, you know, the three of us in the water, or the, you know, the four of us, including our dive controller, had a strange euphoria at coming through the accident, in that we don't really, none of us really, I don't think anyway, feel we've been traumatized in any way. And, you know, we were back at work pretty soon after and stuff like that. So, but those who had to watch it on screen, so as I said, that footage, you know, lasts 40 minutes and, you know, 100 odd people on the boat, all of them were out their bunks, all of it watching it on screens, powerless to do anything about it. And on many of them, it had much more of an effect on them than it did on us, and have had, you know, people have had sleepless nights, and many never decided never to work with divers again and things like that. So it's a strange thing with trauma and incidents that, you know, it can affect witnesses more than it can those involved.
Yes, it's an interesting one, because it's I don't mean to minimize it at all, because it's ridiculous what happened, but it's almost like, because you were passed out for it, it's almost like you've observed it happen to somebody else, the way that you're talking about it, because although you experienced it and you lived it, there's almost a bit of a gap from what you're saying as well, and you're hearing things the first, you know, later on. It's fascinating.
That's massively accurate. I was just a damsel in distress, you know. I didn't do anything, you know. I just lay there and passed out, really. And you know, if there are, I get so many emails, you know, literally every day, and lovely messages from people who've seen the film, or, you know, when I ask you questions and things like that, which is lovely, you know. And, you know, they sort of say lovely things, but the truth is, you know, there's nothing heroic about anything I did. I just lay there, you know. And if there's any heroes in this story, it's those guys who came to fetch me. And you're absolutely right. I often feel disassociated from it. I watch the film and I'm the same as you. I wonder if he's going to make it, you know. And it's strange. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm guessing a lot of people ask you, like, what's the meaning of life? What's it like to die? What do you kind of say to those people then when they're asking these sort of questions?
Well, I didn't die, did I? That's a thing. And you don't want to, I'm always conscious that there are people who suffer enormously in this world, aren't there? And there are people who suffer traumas where they, you know, horrendous life changing injuries and on a daily basis. And there are also people who are given terminal prognosis every day, you know, cancer patients and stuff like that. You know, mine was a bit more, you know, it felt at the time anyway like I had 3 or 4 minutes. So yeah, I don't like to pretend that I've suffered more than I have, but yeah, I do get asked that question a lot. And I always feel like I disappoint people when I say to people, I didn't really have an epiphany, if you like. You know, I didn't really wake up the next day thinking, oh my goodness, I need to make the best of my life and all like that. You know, but I like to think I'm like that anyway, you know, that you know, a lot of us are, aren't they? That, you know, you get up every day trying to better yourself and you know, and enjoy life and so on and so forth. As an example, I had someone stop me in the local shop, an older lady, and she asked me pretty much what you just asked me, you know, what's it like to die, you know? And I sort of tried to tell her really that it was, it seemed okay, like I said to Stu in that moment, that it wasn't an unpleasant experience. It was very, very frightening few minutes leading up to it, because I knew it, well, I thought I knew it was coming, but the actual moment of death, if you like, was, I always describe it as, you know, you're going to sleep last night, that you sort of remember going to bed, you remember, you know, chatting to whoever, or, you know, going on your phone or whatever. You remember your thoughts before you went to sleep, but you don't remember the actual moment of passing into unconsciousness, basically. You know, for me, it was very much like that. In a strange way, that seems to reassure a lot of people. And this lady had just lost her husband, you know, she didn't tell me that till afterwards. And she sort of liked that reassurance. And I don't know how genuine that is, but if I can offer that crumb of comfort to people, then, you know, obviously I'll always try and do so, you know. You know, for me, the only thing that's really changed, I think, is that perhaps I have a slightly more acute awareness of death than, I suppose, we all think about death, don't we, you know, and the finality of it and all that kind of thing. And, you know, it's coming to us all, isn't it? It's just a case of when. So, you know, I generally don't try and think about it, because there's nothing zero I can do about it, and you're better off worrying about living your life, aren't you? And, I think I was like that before, but occasionally I think about it maybe a little bit more than normal.
Yeah, I guess that's natural as well, especially with the documentary coming out and it focuses so heavily on the situation and people asking you these questions. I can imagine it brings it to your mind more. Just watching it made me think more about death and what, you know, it must be like and what you've experienced and all that sort of stuff. So for you to be in it, I can imagine, it probably has that happened? Has, since the documentary's come out, has it kind of given you any new kind of shifts in thinking in any way?
Definitely, yeah, absolutely. It's forced us to think about it a lot. I think at the time that it actually happened, so was a documentary in 20, so we probably it's probably about a 7-year gap between the accident and actually making that documentary. In the interim, we'd actually made another little in-house film, which was a sort of the trigger for this documentary. But that process, or both of those processes, was cathartic in many ways, but it forced us to, probably forced me, I think, I've not really talked to the other lads about it too much, but certainly forced me to revisit what had happened. I think at the time I was young and I would say a bit dumber perhaps, and my worries were very selfish at the time, that I was, remember being concerned about my job and, you know, am I going to get back to work and things like that? Is my career over? And I sort of rushed back to work 3 weeks later, given, you know, the first opportunity. And, you know, as you get older and you've got kids and stuff now, and you begin to realize that I perhaps should have spoken to those who love me a little bit more and thought more of their feelings and things like that. It's forced me to consider elements like that. And, I think at the time I didn't perhaps appreciate the gravity of what happened, you know, particularly, from other people's perspectives. But just generally it's good to talk things through, isn't it? And through any situation. So that's this, you know, I'm talking to you now and I do this kind of thing a lot really, and speak to people and, you know, occasionally present it and talk to people about it. And, give them a bit of insight, and every time I do it, it's maybe cathartic in its own way, really. And maybe that's the reason why I and, you know, the three of us haven't really suffered too much, whereas those who didn't have the ability to do that, it harrows them a little bit more.
Yeah, because I can imagine it must be quite strange to see your friends and colleagues talk so openly on camera about what happened. And obviously when the camera's on and you've got a good interviewer as well, things come out that maybe you didn't expect. So you're probably thinking, right, I'm not going to quite cry when I say this. And then suddenly it's all come out. So I can imagine it must be quite a cathartic experience to go back and watch a documentary of your life. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's mad. We do. I mean, I cry in a film, don't I? I'm not ashamed of crying, but it's not something I do normally. And I think Duncan gets very emotional. Dave doesn't, but that's just his character. But yeah, it's amazing how the power of a camera in a dark room and somebody looking in your eyes and asking searching questions has on you.
Oh, that bit when you come in and the camera's out of focus, like, I think that's him, I think that's Chris, I think he's alive. That was a great reveal.
It's amazing because I know when you talk about, you know, watching yourself. So when I was on holiday when they first sent me the first sort of cut of the film. And I thought, I didn't realise they were going to do that. They were going to hide my not being alive, you know. As I said, we made a previous, so it's like a 45-minute version. They don't do that, you know. You know I'm alive from the start. And I thought, there's just no way that's not going to fool anybody. You know, it's very obvious all the way through that I'm alive. But actually, yeah, it goes to show. That's just because I know the answer. But everybody is like you, really. And it seems to be a powerful emotional bit of the film. Step out.
And I'm saying to people, don't Google it. Don't try and work out what's happened. Just watch the documentary. Just watch this documentary on Netflix because it's so good. But don't, because I'm so glad, because it's a bit like, when you went to watch Sixth Sense, I didn't know Bruce Willis, and it's completely different. But obviously, I didn't know the spoiler alert there. Obviously, it's too late now for people 20 years on. But so I'm so glad that I just clicked play. But anyway.
We were worried about that when we were making it, I remember saying, well, because we talked about having to do publicity when it first came out, because we ended up going on TV and stuff like that. And Morag and I went on the One Show and stuff. It was very embarrassing, but I thought, this is going to ruin it, you know. And they said to me, look, you watch Titanic, you know they're going to die at the end, but you still worry about when they die. So actually, you know,
good point.
Right, really,
it was done really well. So can you talk to us a bit about your public speaking then? So what is it you're doing nowadays? You're going around and you're talking to different groups of people. Can you share a bit about what that is?
Yeah, I still work as a diver. I'm still on the same boat, in fact, and I often dive with Duncan. Dave's moved on recently, but yeah, so I still have a day job. But I got asked quite a lot just to go and, you know, tell people the story. And I did it badly to begin with, and I sort of grown into it. And so nowadays I travel the world, but I get very kindly invited to various places. And although recently it's just been on Zoom like this and so on, and tell people the story. And I show sort of little excerpts from the film and try and give them an insight into into what went on and the lessons we learn. And, you know, depending on the context, sometimes it's sort of a leadership thing, or sometimes it's a safety seminar, or sometimes it's just a very, just telling you that what is basically a very human story and about the fragility of life. And that, you know, if we're talking about safety, that, you know, the truth is it all comes down to the people at the end of the, at the end of the day, and how, you know, you've got people's lives in your hands when you're dealing with these things. So yeah, it's lovely. I kind of enjoy telling the story, and people seem very receptive to it. So yeah, it's been a nice thing to come out of what was, you know, obviously a sort of traumatic incident. It's hopefully a bit of a positive. Yeah.
Yeah. No, fantastic. So if people want to book you and know more about your public speaking, how can they find you?
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say that. Well, I've got a website. So if you go on chrislemons.co.uk, you can find me and get in touch with me there. And yeah, be absolutely delighted to come on and tell anybody about it in more detail and working into sort of any working environment, really. Yeah. So yeah, thanks for mentioning it, Mike.
No, of course. And I'll put the link in the description below, guys, so you can go to the website. Also, if you haven't done so, after this podcast, guys, stop what you're doing and go to Netflix and watch Last Breath, because it's definitely worth your time. Last question I've got for you, and it's a bit of a silly one, but how the hell do you live on that little capsule with like three or four other blokes? Because I've had some dodgy roommates in the past, and after 6 months, I want to kill them. And I can go out of the house, and I can, you know, how the hell are you all in that capsule? What is going on there mentally?
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, to be honest, that's the difficult bit of the job. The diving is very much the light relief every day. Yeah. Really, you know, we spend about 6 hours in the water every day, but the other 18 you've got to spend, as you say, in so just they're sort of 2 meters high by 2 meters wide tubes. Really, it's, you know, it's very, very small. And yeah, when I go to bed at night, you know, I can reach out. I don't even have to reach out that much, and I can touch the person next to me and the person above me. So if you like your privacy, everything you do is on camera. You know, you get the toilet on camera, you shower on camera. But yeah, absolutely. The difficult thing is getting on with the other people. And that's the skill in the job, actually, is being a nice chap, I suppose. And but it's a weird job, really, because people always imagine it's going to be a sort of macho environment. I think, you know, quite a few ex sort of military types who do that kind of work. But the truth is, particularly where I work, we're very, you know, aggressive, rude, messy people tend to get wheedled out because people don't want to live with them in those circumstances. So actually, yeah, strangely, you tend to find people are quite placid and accommodating and understanding of other people's problems, because we're all in the same boat, you know, and nobody wants to be in there, really. And yeah, so you sort of make allowances for other people and try and be patient and so on. I'm not saying that works all the time, but
no.
Yeah, that's definitely the hard bit. Yeah.
does it make you appreciate it when you're not in there? So when you're at home right now and you've got all the space and privacy, do you appreciate it more?
You've no idea. I don't know. I mean, we're limited to, we're there for 28 days normally. That's the sort of the legal limit in UK waters. You know, they won't allow you to stay in there any longer than that, the government, thank goodness. And I always equate it to that, you know, when you were a kid and you were at school and it was the school holidays, you know, and that last day of school when you were running out, and it was just like heaven, wasn't it? They've got six weeks of freedom. And it's like that every time for me. Yeah. I don't say I hate my job, because I do, but I love what I do most of the time. But nobody, if anybody tells you they enjoy living in there, they are lying. It's massively liberating. And you dream of, open spaces and fresh air and drinking a whiskey in front of the fire and stuff.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, mate. Thank you so much. That far exceeded my expectations in terms of, I already knew how great it was going to be, but I just wanted to get stuck into the detail with you because, you've helped clear up a few questions I had around it. So thank you so much. Guys, again, descriptions below. Go ahead, check the documentary out, find Chris on his website. Chris, any last words from yourself?
Not really, but just to say, it's my pleasure. And it was nice to talk to people and to nice people as well. So thanks very much, Mike, for taking an interest and saying hello, you know. And as I said, glad to tell anybody about it in any more detail. Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. That's it. Great. Thanks very much. And guys, we'll see you on the next podcast. Cheers.
Cheerio.